Welcome to Behind the Sports Medicine Podcast, the podcast that pulls back the curtain on the evolving world of sports science. I'm Andrew Rizza, an athlete trainer with decades of experience in professional, collegiate, and high school sports.
And I'm Cameron Roth, an orthopedic surgeon and a consultant for the Chicago White Sox.
In each episode, we'll explore the real-world challenges and opportunities facing today's human performance professionals.
Our hands-on experience is transforming sports medicine and breaking barriers through innovation and teamwork.
We are live here today at the Harvard Varsity Club. We're lucky enough to have former New England Patriot, two-time Super Bowl champion Rob Ninkovich, and former New England Patriot team physician Dr. Thomas Gill.
And three-time Super Bowl champion.
And three-time Super Bowl champion, more than Rob.
This guy's put me under before. So
it's a pretty unique opportunity to have a former team physician and a former team player here, so we're very lucky to have them. We were talking earlier, Rob, obviously you know Dr. Gill for a long, long time. How did your first interaction go, and how did you guys establish trust during your career with the New England Patriots?
Yeah, well, I think that starts from the first day you arrive in training camp and you start to meet the staff and your medical. And, you know, I think that there's always that trust progress. So you have to start to get to know your staff and everybody that's affiliated with the Patriots, and the comfort level there that has to always go hand in hand. And, you know, I think to my first day in New England, 2009, that's really when you start to, you know, create those relationships. And over time, I mean, football is a 100% injury sport. So it doesn't matter if you're, you know, the kicker, you're dealing with something at some point. And, you know, developing that trust and, you know, having that relationship really helps when it comes to, you have something going on. Doc, you know, I need you to check this out. You know, I'm sure he's sick of me texting him sometimes because, you know, but I think that the person-to-person relationship is probably the most important thing when it comes to dealing with an injury. You know, as a rookie, I had dealt with a major injury, and there's a physical side to everything, but then I think there's that mental side that if you have the trust and you know that your best interest, they're looking out for you. That's when it's a good thing for the physical side of rehab and the mental side of rehab.
What about you, Dr. Gill?
You know, I think it's Rob hit the nail on the head. It's about trust. And I think one of the ways as a physician that I try to get trust is try to be completely open, mm-hmm. transparent. If I'm showing you your radiology or your MRI, I'm also going to show you what the radiologist said about it.
Yep.
You want me to call anyone in your family? Encourage if you're not comfortable with what I'm saying, a couple of people I can recommend for a second opinion, and then let you know that I see you as you're a human being first and you're an athlete second,
right? Yeah.
And so I've got your best interest at heart. Go talk to the other guys in the locker room, find out what their experience has been like. Because I think as soon as there's, and actually I wanted to ask you, is it one of the things I think people think that there's an inherent distrust between athletes and their team doctors because they think they work for the team? Is that a myth? Is that real? And because one of the things we've always tried to say is if I cut a corner or try to send you back too soon, I only have to do that once.
Yeah.
And I'll lose the locker room for the next 10 years. So yep. Why would I ever do that?
Yeah, 100%. No, I think each team is different. You know, I played for three different teams. You know, I go back to college when I was at junior college. It was a little bit different. You didn't have much of a team aspect of doctors and medical. You're getting your ankles taped in like a back barn or something. It's pretty interesting there, but it's a great story. You know, and then when I was at Purdue, I think for me, I always had this common sense approach to an injury, and I was always knowing in the back of my head, if an injury was to affect my time on the field, then that affects my opportunity. So as a player, you're always trying to stay as healthy as possible, do your very best, and also have the best medical and listen to what they're trying to tell you. So that trust process comes into, you know, what they're trying to give you the information to get better. I had one rolled ankle at Purdue. That was it. I rolled my ankle once doing like jump rope or something. It was stupid, but it was right before spring ball, and I was so kind of competitive and didn't want to lose my opportunity. I did whatever I had to do to get back, and I didn't really miss any time. They put me in a boot for a day. I said, it's going to make my calf weaker. So I just did a little moleskin, if you guys know what that is. A couple figure eight locks on the heel.
There and, you go. Rock and roll.
Just rock and roll. Tie that thing down. And it hurt for a little bit, but you know what? Pain is temporary. So,
and by the way, that's the type of thing, though, from a medical staff standpoint, that's one of the things that I say, that might hurt you, but it's not going to hurt it.
Yes.
So there are certain injuries that you can do that for.
Yeah.
You tear your ACL and you try to get up there and play.
You're going to damage your meniscus. That, yeah.
Right? So we're just cartilage. There's some things you can do that for and some things you can't.
So to answer that question, I think that there's different levels to trust. You know, I think that in my experience with New England, with yourself, I always felt very comfortable with the care that I was given. I always felt like I was put first. You know, I have seen unfortunate instances in the past with other teams where that's not the case. Because at the end of the day, the level of professional football and college is completely different. We know, we understand that professional football is an entertainment business, and through entertainment, you need the players, you need the horses, right? You don't have, you can't have donkeys out there. You need the horses.
Right.
So it's trying to get and field the most athletic and best performing athletes. And you understand that. So for me, I always understood my job is to be as healthy as possible, to stay healthy, to play through pain if I have to play through pain, because that's just the nature of the business. Within reason, you know, I did have a pretty terrible knee injury that I got through, but it took me a year. But the trust process, I think that, and the understanding of what your best interests are, that comes with time. You know, it really does. It comes with building that relationship, you know, communication. And also, you know, Doc, if you saw me come walk in, he probably knew that I was dealing with something, like something that was bothering me. Because if it was something minute, I'm not talking to him. You know, like I'm just.
You give me a hard time. About
I would give, yeah, I'd give him a hard time about his reporting on something. You know, like, but they put a sign in my locker. It was called Dr. Ninko. Sounds pretty scary, actually.
That was put there by the medical staff.
Yeah, the medical staff put me there because I would always be interested, and I always thought it was interesting to like look at the different injuries and what football and how guys rehab and how, you know, I could the ice stuff, the rice, you know, that goes a long way. It goes a long way. Put some ice on it. You'll be all right.
Throw some dirt on it.
Yeah, right.
Yeah.
Our live episodes at the Harvard University Varsity Club are brought to you by our friends at MetOne Orthopedics. Are you looking for innovation in orthopedics? Meet the only U.S.-based Latin-owned manufacturer now leading the way in upper and lower extremity solutions. They've just expanded their portfolio with the newly launched Fortis Distal Radius Plating System, cleared and designed for next-level performance. This isn't just progress, it's representation, precision, and results, all in one.
We had just recently interviewed Dominique Foxworth, former NFLer as well, and he had mentioned when he was going through his NFL career, he's like, well, we want to stay away from the training room. Nobody wanted to be that training room hangout.
Yeah, so you don't want to be in the training room. I mean, so the training room, there's two aspects of the training room. It's a great relationship builder when it comes to the guys in there. You build a relationship with the training staff, like we were talking about earlier. But then there's also a side to the football operations that look, okay, well, if this guy's in here every day, is that a problem for him long term?
Yeah.
And I think back to 2008, the Miami Dolphins. I was there in 07. They had a terrible season. They're 1-15. Terrible. Yeah. Cam Cameron was their head coach. Just didn't work well. But then in 2008, Bill Parcells comes in as the president. And in his first team speech, he brought the injury log and he brought the book and he put it on the table. He put it down, boom. And he goes, you see how thick this is? That's why you guys were 1-15. He's like, this is going to be a quarter of this size or you won't be here.
Yeah.
And that's what his speech was.
He gave the same speech to the docs when he showed up in New England. Let's get one thing straight. I don't like doctors.
Yeah.
Let's get the second thing straight. I still don't like doctors.
Yeah.
And the third issue is I never want to see a guy miss a game for a hand injury or a foot injury. Are we clear?
Are we clear?
Like, so would you do it on the QT? Hey, Doc, can you meet me down the street at the Sunoco?
Well, take
a look at my hand. Yeah.
I learned early my rookie year I had an injury. So it was like The one thing I would say, like full transparency, is when you're playing in the NFL and you are providing a service that people, obviously they know that you're doing that on the field, there is a mental side of it when you do have a serious injury that is completely gone. So like, hey, Ninko, what's up? Or like having a good conversation while you're playing. But then when you get hurt, you're not available. Mm-hmm. So that's, you're gone. You know, you're not existent. So that's a hard part to deal with. But I'm happy that I had that early. You know, I'm happy that I had this big, you know, I tore my ACL, my MCL, my PCL, my meniscus, chunked the cartilage, all the fun stuff, right? Mm-hmm. The triad. It's that the triad where you get the whole shebang. Yeah, Dr. Ninko. So, you know, when I had that, I went to Dr. Andrews, and you know, he was he the first patella allograft? He was the guy that was really using that, James Andrews, right? On the patella to the knee, yep. Right? Some other doctors. I mean, this was 2006, so it was a few years. Right, that was kind of like becoming the most popular option versus hamstring, quad, tendon, all that stuff that you lose a percentage of strength,
yep,
that you don't want as a athlete. So I went down there. It tore it on a Monday. I was in his office on Tuesday, which now is different, right? They make you, you know, get the swelling out, create, you know, do some more strengthening stuff. I literally tore it on Monday. I had surgery Wednesday to fix it. And I remember going and visiting him, and he was looking at the MRI. He's like, yeah, we'll fix your ACL. You know, your MCL is going to heal on its own. Your meniscus will throw us a couple sutures in, try and save it. You're going to be non-weight bearing for a little bit because you have this medial bone bruise. I think you'll be all right. And I'm sitting there like, oh, I feel like a flamingo right now. My knee's going the wrong way, but sweet. So we did the surgery. And I had a great rehab. You know, I was back in eight months,
full
brace. So I think the really big encouraging part was my teammate, my draft teammate, Roman Harper. I tore mine on a Monday night. He tore his Sunday, that next game in Tampa. So he had just an ACL tear. So he didn't have really any other damage. So when he was rehabbing, I was rehabbing with him. We were doing the same, you know, range of motion stuff. We were doing the same. I tried to run when he started to run, which I shouldn't have. And I think it really pushed me. And Roman, you know, one of my best friends, and he was in my wedding. We really bonded with trying to get through that. You know, having somebody that has the same injury pushing each other to get back. And we had this whole thing, like, no braces. We're not going to have a brace on this thing. I'm not wearing a Donjoy. I'm not wearing a sleeve. It's just an aid anyway. So, you know, I think when you have people going through a similar injury, you learn from it. So I knew a knee, like all aspects of the knee. You know, what's this? What's that? Because unfortunately, you're going to have knee injuries in football. It's just part of it. So going through that at a young age taught me a lot about the process of how do you deal with the injury, the mental side of dealing with not being available, you know, looking at a team when you're playing for a team that you're on IR for and they're going into the NFC championship game, you're thinking to yourself like, damn, I'd be playing in the NFC championship right now, but I'm freaking trying to walk or trying to run. You know, it's very tough when you're trying to deal with those mental struggles of I should be playing, but I freaking put my foot in the wrong spot and I got caught. And then you're trying to get back. And now, especially, you'll see somebody tear their ACL and they're like, he'll be back in 6 months. You're like, it's not as easy as that. You got to go through a long process and regain all that mental confidence. And hey, I'm going to run as fast as I can and stick my foot in field turf and hope that whole thing holds together. So,
Rob, compare when you started, like how that decision got made where you were going to go. It sounds like that was very much a you-oriented
thing,
like when you were in college.
Yep.
You knowing the players through now, it's been my impression that a lot of it's less about where the player makes that decision, but whether it's their agent, their people. I'm not sure how much the other players, do you guys talk about it with each other about, hey, where did you have yours done? What do I have mine done? Like, how do you think that decision is getting made more today?
So I think today there's a lot more influence with agencies because obviously with NIL and they have these handlers that are trying to really direct the career. I'm sure you've seen guys go to spots you don't want them to go to, right, and they do it anyway. They don't listen. And I've seen, unfortunately, you see guys that go somewhere and they have it done and it's not right, and they can never get back to where they were. I mean, I would say, and I think talking especially about knee injuries, any injury, there's probably more of the sad story on how it didn't turn out the right way because of either a rehab practice. You know, when I think back on my rehab, I'm very lucky that I didn't have a problem with my rehab process, because the rehab that I was doing, I shouldn't have been doing some of the extension stuff at the time that I was doing it. I shouldn't have been doing some of the running I was doing in the time I was doing it. And I was learning that through my own readings and studying, okay, I shouldn't be doing this right now. And some guys don't have the wherewithal to say that, and they'll just do it anyway.
So I'll tell you what we used to do that I thought was incredibly effective, and I've done this with Andrew with some of his athletes, but you know, there's always someone from the Patriots training staff that when we were operating on, we operated, almost all the guys kind of stayed home and had to take care of them, but we would always have one of the training staff with us so they can see exactly what was wrong, what that cartilage in your knee looked like, how strong the repair is. We're talking during the case. All right, so when can I get Rob's knee moving? What do you think his weight bearing should be? So everybody's on the same page. Yeah. We know how strong, how well the surgery went, if there were any complications. And when your rehab could be directed by someone also that was in there at the time of surgery, I think the level of care just elevates. And that's one of the things about keeping it with your staff when you can.
Everybody has to be on the same page. And it's just like, you know, when you're on the field defensively, everyone has to understand the information. If it only takes one person that doesn't get it, and you're screwed. So, you know, I think back to, and I don't want to talk negative, but the Saints, in my personal experience, you know, that the trainer probably didn't really think that I was going to be a long career type guy. So I think me as a fifth round pick versus Roman as a second round pick, there was a difference in attention on the care. And that does happen, unfortunately. And I think when you see that, it automatically puts you in this mindset of, okay, well, I need to make sure that I take care of everything that I can do. Yeah. And even though I'm being told something, like, I don't think, and just this was through reading, like doing leg extensions in the first 4 weeks of an ACL repair wasn't smart.
It's pretty impressive, actually.
You know?
That's good.
Yeah. So
that's
true. You,
I mean, seriously, that's a great thing to have done.
Yeah, because you know, when you're doing it at the time and you're feeling, because I do have a Cyclops lesion, so the notch inside my, you know, where the ACL goes. In 2006, they didn't realize that your own body's autonomy on where that you could have it forward or, you know, wherever that's facing. They just had a one-size-fits-all ACL placement. It was like, okay, this is where it goes, put it through, and then, hey, guess what? You might have a little clunk in the top of your extension. You know, so then you start to develop that Cyclops, which I've had it my whole life, or not my whole life, but my whole career after the fact. Doesn't affect my ability to play, but it has affected a little bit of my extension, which over time would create some, you know, a little bit of arthritis. So, but 50% of people are going to have arthritis anyway if you have an ACL, so it's fine.
So let me ask you this. So when you were going
look at this.
Yeah, we talk about it all the time.
Yeah.
So when you were going through your rehab process, who was overseeing that at the time? You say you were doing reading and you were doing
So
stuff
I would
ahead
get a card. I would just get a card. I'd walk in and then that was up to
really?
Me to
so
do
there
it.
Was no overview so, of guidance, one-on-one?
There was a little was bit, but it wasn't as specific as what I got in New England.
And so, that was through the organization you were with that we will remain nameless?
I think that definitely is organization-to-organization difference. I mean, the guy that was the head is not the head anymore, so that's also like it starts like again at the top and it works its way down. But you know, I think when you have that, you think about a locker room in general, you start the season, you have like a small group. As the season progresses, that group grows and grows and grows. But also what happens in that timeline is you have a guy with an injury that has a surgery on week 4 and he's progressing into week 10 to 12 to 13, and then you have maybe a week 2 or 3 ACL repair coming in. So it's, you have to be able to manage those timelines. And I think that that's where your staffing comes in.
Yeah.
Like, okay, if you only have six people and you have 15 to 18 guys, maybe four ACLs, maybe six labrum tears, maybe ankles. There's a wide variety of injuries that you're trying to, you know, delegate all these people to. And, you know, I think the best and most important thing I learned was getting my range of motion. If you don't get your range, you're screwed. And, you know, we see all these issues of people back in the 80s where they would cast them and right. No range, and then they calcified and had all these problems. The range was the most important thing. So I was like, all right, let me get my range and do whatever I got to do. I mean, I still to this day, I'll look at my phone or read a book hanging my heels off the end of the bed. You know, it's just to try and really get that, you got to get it. And
yeah. Rob, let me ask you a question about from the rehab standpoint, though. Like when you were there, you had, you know, Jim Whalen and,
Jimbo.
And Joe Van Allen and Dave Greeno. In my opinion, those guys
are the best
in the business.
Best in the business, yeah.
And then, but that being said, do you think this trend now, not just in football, I know in basketball this is huge, and then baseball it's starting to come into play, when every guy's got his
their own guy.
His guru, and then they want them in the locker room. As a player, does that confuse you? Does that start to undermine your confidence in the organization? Do you feel like, well, why does he need to do it? Maybe I need my own guy. And do you feel like that's a negative for the chemistry of the team?
Yeah, I think it's getting worse because of this, you know, before football was a team aspect, but now with the college stuff, there's more independence and individuality, which each guy has their own guy and their own program and their own speed guy and their own massage guy and all this stuff. You know, when you come into a team like the Patriots, and I think that the reason why they had a lot of success, number one, they had great athletes. Number two, they had a great mentality. And then they also had great employees that had the same type of goals. Okay, let's get this team to be the best team we can. Let's make sure that we field the best team possible, the healthiest team. You know, I'm still friends, you know, Joe and, you know, Joe Van Allen he's taped my ankles every single week, you know, he wouldn't travel for the preseason. So I would be like, damn it. I can't get the right tape job now. Like I can't get the right pressure here. I'm going to get an arch ache, you know, but, when you get that arch foot ache, man, is it bad. But Jimbo, you know, still great friends with Jim, Whalen. He's done a terrific job. Yeah. He does a great job of leadership and, you know, understanding and trying to put himself in the player's mind, the player's mindset. And I do believe that the more gurus that you have could potentially be harder for the staff when you're trying to relay a message or tell them, hey, like, listen, I wouldn't massage that bruise. It might bleed a little bit because a bruise is just bleeding. So
right.
I'd put, you know, leave it alone. Let's try and mitigate the swelling and, you know, don't use heat on it. It's, you know, there's definitely some contradictory opinions on how to do things. And I think back to when I was in college. Now, there was this whole, like, I don't know if you guys remember this. It was like the STEM.
The STEM machines.
STEM machines. But it was like literally turning it up to 10 and then trying to squat with it.
Yeah.
And it was this crazy, weird.
Being electrified.
Yeah. So I remember watching people. And this is just me having common sense. I would look at somebody doing it and there would be some guy like, yeah, this is the best. This is just gonna, what it do is training your muscles to like be over stimulated and then you're squatting with it and tearing the muscle fiber. I'm thinking that's a great way to tear your quad or something. Like,
does it sound like blood flow restriction to anyone? No, just kidding.
Yeah.
Blood flow restriction. Like, hey, we put that around our necks. You know, it's like, yeah, you could do your jaw muscles with no, just put it around your neck. It's great. It's good for the blood flow. I would see these things and say like, man, that doesn't make sense to me. Like, I think that's just a fad.
Yeah.
And now it's gone.
Yeah.
People were spending like $10,000 on these STEM machines and trying to do a full workout with your muscles at zone 10. And it's extremely painful. And I'm like, you don't have to do that. It doesn't make sense. You know? So, I think there's a little bit of common sense that you have to have as well. Like, all right, that doesn't make sense. Or let me look into it a little bit besides just jumping into this fad.
We talked to Dr. Andrews and Dr. Gill about what it's like to be the team doc in helping a player decide when it's time to retire.
Yeah.
So from the player perspective, what was that like to interact with the medical staff when you were thinking and considering about playing your last season?
I was thinking of that for a long time.
Okay.
Listen, when you play football, you're burning it from both ends. We know that. And I was lucky to have a very healthy career. I mean, honestly, when it comes to injuries, when I went to the combine, I remember the medical people looking at my college career, and they're like, so you had one ankle roll?
Injury, yeah.
I was like, yeah, that's it. They're like, that's all you've had in your whole career. I said, yeah, I just rolled my ankle, jumping rope. I'm good now. That was fine. And there was a lot of guys that had ACLs, you know, ankles, bone problems, all these things. I mean, I never jammed a finger in 20 years of football, which is kind of crazy.
You were tackling?
Yeah.
I mean, I must just be lucky, or I have sausage fingers. Yeah, exactly. I was a side tackle. But I think that process is individual. And now there's a physical side to playing football, but then, like I said before, this mental side. And some guys can't let go of the mental side of not having the ideology of being a football player. And now I think that comes into each and every different person that's an athlete. Like, you have I am a football player, and that's what I am. So that's hard to let go. A lot of guys can't let that go. That's why you see guys play. And there's only three ways to leave the game. It's your way, it's their way, or it's injured. 90% of guys leave injured or their way. So they say, hey, you're not good enough, or hey, we're going to let you go. Hey, your contract's too high, which is all bullshit. They're just letting you know that you can't do it anymore. So I think having that injury my rookie year and giving me a different perspective on time, because it doesn't matter how much you make, or it's all time-based. Like, we only have a certain amount of time. So if you're playing football, yeah, guys are trying to make a lot of money, but you don't know when your last play is. So if you're blessed to be able to play longer than you're expecting to play, then you have all the leverage on letting go when you want to let go. And I wanted to retire after Seattle. That was my eighth year. But I really only played because I didn't play my rookie year, had the injury. My second and third year, I didn't play much because just circumstance. I didn't have an opportunity. And then when I got here in 09, special teams, 2010. So from 10 to 16 was really like my run. And after Seattle, I thought, like, man, maybe I should let it go. Like, just, I won my Super Bowl. I'm in my ninth year, move on to the next thing. And then I was like, no, let's go. We could go back to back. So I went to the 10. And honestly, 10 was going to be my last year. I was going to retire. But then I had an unfortunate situation where I was going through the off season. I had taken some supplement that had DHEA in it, which I didn't realize had it in there. I wish I would have been smarter in that. But that's another thing, that you're trying to maximize what you have at 32, mm-hmm. 31. It's not like you're 22, 23. So you're trying to stay strong. You're trying to stay fast. So I was like, I'm not going out that way. I'm not retiring because I made a mistake. So I'm like, I'll serve what I got to do. I got to serve my four games. I'll do it. This is going to be my last year. I knew it was my last year from the second I got back. And I enjoyed that last year. Like, I knew going into the Super Bowl, this is the last time I'm ever going to put a helmet on. And there's some, to me, I felt great about it. And I love football. I love football. I thought it gave me everything that I wanted in life. It gave me the discipline, you know, taught me a ton of lessons that I'd pass on to my kids. But at the end of the day, I didn't want to go out somebody else's way. I wanted to go out my way because I made it to that point. I made my career the way I wanted it to go. And it wasn't hard. It really wasn't hard. I think the year to 2 years after, when you could still probably play at a high level and they still want you to play, that's, you're like, you know what? But I kept thinking about the bank robber that goes back for that one last grab. You know, they get away scot-free. Everything's great. They have everything they ever wanted, and they go back for that one more, and they get popped. And I'm like, okay.
The town.
Or, you know, I'm thinking Place Beyond the Pines, right? Yeah. The guy just one time, and I'm done. And you go, and you get caught, or you get killed. And for me, I was like, I go back and I pop my Achilles. I go back and I tear my ACL. It's not worth what they're paying me at all. And for me, you know, I think a lot of guys, they don't look at this long-term projection on what are the next 10 years look like. Okay, if I take everything in 10-year increments, okay, from 20 to 30, 30 to 40, 40 to 50. I think right now, 10 years ago, I had a 2-year-old and no boys. Now I got a 12-year-old and 2 boys. Mm-hmm. You know, in 10 years, I'm going to have a 22-year-old and 2 teenage boys. So it's like...
Good luck with that, by the way.
Yeah, I know. I know. I know. So it's... I think when I was going through the process, only you can make that decision on if you're ready to go. Mm-hmm. And now your body's kind of talking to you. Science was talking to me because I did a lot of reading and a lot of research. Okay, like
the more
I read about it, the more I understand that I'm lucky to have played this long, but I also know the long-term risks involved in playing 20 years. You know, statistically, 15% every 3 years. So it's not great if you...
Does the med staff do any counseling of the players when they're about to retire?
What
to expect in the next 5-10 years, or do you just walk out the door and
you just
it's like the military, they just give you your papers and you're gone.
What I always said that Players Association, I think if they wanted to be really proactive and be a value added for you guys, it's great to have an agent for while you're playing the game. I think they should have post-career agents. How do you get quote unquote back into society, whether it's finding a new job, whether it's financial planning, whether it's medical, someone to help you and then to deal with that time around retirement. I always thought that would be a valuable type of service.
I think that's a tough thing for agents. You know, so for example, I met my financial advisor at a Christmas party in 2006. His main guy was Al Copeland, who created Popeye's Chicken. So Al's son, Al Jr.'s daughter, is my wife's best friend. So that's how I got the invite. I walk in this mansion. I'm like, dude, this guy's got a picture of himself on a cheetah rug. You know, like
fried chicken, cheetah rugs. That's what I'm talking about.
Like, the dude had a weight room. He was like in his late 60s with people working out with him.
Yeah.
And I'm like, yo, what is this going on here?
Getting back to retirement.
So I'm talking to Lee, who is, you know, I met through my wife, and he's like, I don't deal with athletes. And I just asked him, like, hey, you know, I'm looking for an advisor. He's like, I don't deal with athletes. I had one athlete once, you know, he had 120 grand to his name and he bought a $150,000 Mercedes. You know, he's like, I don't deal with athletes. So I was like, all right, well, maybe one day, you know, we could just kind of have a conversation. And then I started working with him like 4 years later. But, you know, I think you have to be willing to listen. You know, a lot of players don't listen, and then they think they're going to play forever. And they think it's going to keep going forever. And, you know, unfortunately, that's just not the case. Like, you're not going to play forever. You're not going to have this income forever. So if you have a platform, you know, that's why, you know, when I retired, I stuck around New England area because, you know, there's more opportunity. You can do a lot of things through a lot of different businesses, companies. You know, I was working at ESPN. I worked for Boston Private Bank. I did a bunch of different things that if I was in Cleveland, Ohio, it just wouldn't have been the same opportunity. So I think especially guys that played in great areas with, you know, a lot of money. And, you know, I think to the Giants, you know, Justin Tuck, I do believe. I think he works for a bank and does like investments and he won Super Bowls there. You got to maximize your earning potential after as well. And I think some guys don't realize that that's an opportunity. But I also think, and now we're going into this different tangent, but I think we're not creating a good foundation for players now with NIL. So if you go to 4 different colleges in 5 years, what are you learning as far as mm-hmm. your long-term career goals? Like, do you have a major that you're actually going to graduate from a school with, or are you just chasing $400,000 to $500,000? Because mm-hmm. at the end of the day, you know, if you make $1 million, yeah, that's great. In 4 years or 5 years of college, that's not going to set you up for the rest. You might have $500,000 after you do your taxes, and that's if you never bought anything. So you might have $200,000 to $300,000 sitting in an account that you don't even know what to do with it, right? And then you don't have a job.
Right.
And if you're making, you know, if you're making, say, conservatively $500,000 as a college football player. Now, that's if you're great. If you're really good, you're making $2 to $4 million. Great. Happy for you. But when that ends, only 1% of college athletes make it to the NFL. Only 1% of those guys play 3+ years to make a pension. You don't have the education or the understanding of how to go get a job or how to deal with, hey, I was making $400,000, but my entry level income is going to be $120,000, or maybe if I'm lucky, 100, maybe 80. You know, so there's going to be like this mental health issue on players trying to figure out what their next move is after not having a education.
That's a great point.
You know?
That's a great point.
Do you think there's anything we can do as the medical staff to
I think so. So I think it comes back to these agents, and because you think about it, the agents are probably pushing these guys to go to different places because they're getting a piece of the money, mm-hmm. right? So it's if they're making 3% and they're going to get a $500,000 bump, and they're getting 3% of 5 to 10 guys that they have, they're looking to, hey man, like this team, they're not going to pay you, but you can go here and you can get $500,000. Like I think you should do it. You know, and these kids are 18, 19, 20 years old.
Mm-hmm. Like, it's a lot of money when you're 18.
It's a lot of money when you're 18. I mean, I think I was 22 when I got drafted, and my signing bonus was like $137,000. And I was like, oh, that's pretty good.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
So, you know, there's a lot of things that are going to pop up that we don't have long-term understanding of. Like, what's the long-term effects of, in 10 years, these guys that started in the NIL, where are they going to be at? Because I know a lot of guys that I went to Purdue with, they were 5-year, you know, red shirt guys. They were 5 years at Purdue. They graduated from Purdue, and they're all working, you know.
Making a great living.
FBI agent, big bank guy, big real estate guys. Like, they're all doing really well. Brain surgeon, you know, like one of my college roommates is a brain surgeon in Chicago. Other college roommates, a private investor for like this billionaire family, lives in London. So it's like all these guys are doing really well.
Yeah.
Now, if they would have left Purdue and went and chased money, maybe they don't have the Purdue degree.
Do you think the NCAA changes what's happening now? Do they, in 1, 2, 3, 5 years, say, we got to change this because of the mental health aspects we're seeing with these athletes? Or is it too far gone?
I think that they opened Pandora's box on the whole like name, image, and likeness, mm-hmm. because now they open that up to say, okay, you try to cap it. Well, then you're capping my name, image, and likeness. Mm-hmm. You try to stop me from transferring. It's very tricky. And I think before I was of the understanding, like, okay, the football team makes all the money for the school. So Purdue, the basketball team, we make all the money for the rest of the sports. So it's swimming, soccer, baseball. Mm-hmm. They're not making any money. They're actually losing money. So we're going to have a problem here with how much can you give to the players and how much is the school making and how much is it spending for other things if you're not a big-time program, right? Like now we're starting to see these smaller programs become even smaller because everyone's trying to get to just the big programs. They're mm-hmm. having these powerhouse programs, and then everyone else is trying to, you know, get the scraps. And it's going to continue. It's going to be a problem. So I think you're seeing it right now. You're seeing it right now. Like some of these small schools, I mean, look at UMass.
Yeah.
You know, they might get 50 people at a game now. They're 0-9, you know, 0-10.
Yeah.
Like before, they used to have a little, or UConn.
Even BC.
BC.
Yeah, even BC.
So I was talking about BC on the radio on Wednesday. So BC, Purdue, some of these schools that consider themselves as an education first school, and they're not going to bank. Because when I got to Purdue, I was surprised. Like there's a lot of guys that didn't make it. They failed out. So they get there and they don't make it because you're on basically your first semester, you're on probation no matter what. To see what your GPA is. If you get over a 3.0, you don't have to go to these mandatory study halls that are like 2 days a week, and they force you basically to go to these things. So me being a transfer, I kind of already had the lingo in the way, like, hey, okay, college is pretty easy. I tell this to all the kids. I'm like, listen, first what you do is go have a relationship with the teacher. So if they see your face,
you make sure that a little again. Explain that a little bit better.
Have a name to name relationship.
Have an academic relationship.
Have an academic relationship. And a lot of guys, if you go to this sociology class or some of these big classes, they go in the back of the room, they sit down, they don't show up some classes, right? They have somebody helping them out or whatever, but then they need a point or a 5 point or a 10 point, they go to the teacher and they say, hi, I'm so, and they're like, I've never seen you before. You're in my class. Like, oh yeah. What do you need? No. So I would always go to class, introduce myself, talk, have go to every, you have to attend class. You know, some of these athletes, they just think like, oh, I'll get it. Like, I can do it. They're just hanging on by the skin of their teeth. Like, going and building relationships, having that, because at the end of the day, the teacher knows who you are. They know that you care about what you're doing, and say you need a point or five, they're going to say, you can make up this, or you can give me that, or yeah, I'll give you that. Like, it works. It really does. So building relationships, communication, which we're losing even more because of digital stuff. Like, I talk to a 20-year-old now, it's different than when I talk to a 40-year-old or 30-year-old. Mm-hmm. They're just like, email me. It's like, no, I don't want to email you. I want to talk to you. Let's have a conversation. You know, right. So I think that's, you know, having those conversations, speaking to people, building trust, that all goes with success. You know, and that's probably the biggest and most important thing, is understanding that when you have a conversation, knowing what you're, knowing the subject, the topic, and communicating that you got it. Like, yeah, okay, this is what we're talking about. This is how we're going to go together. This is how it's going to work. And that's one aspect of things right now. I think we're losing a little bit of that. We're losing the person-to-person contact. It's just going to digital, you know. I emailed you. Like, yeah, I went in my junk. I didn't see it.
I think that's where the questions went today, in the junk mail. They probably did. That's okay.
But yeah, I think we're heading into a difficult way, like, understanding how is this going to work with the future athletes.
Yeah.
And everyone's got their answers, and everyone's got somebody that's helping them, and everyone's got an agenda. But there used to be this team aspect of, hey, I'm going to be with this guy for 4 years. I'm going to know everything about him. But now, every single offseason, you're rebuilding a new team with different group of people.
We had talked about that with, I think, Dr. Andrews. We talked about it with, I think, Charlie, probably Dominique. We talked about this, the NIL, how college coaches now don't have the ability to mentor athletes, and they can't coach them. That's why Saban got out of the game, and that's why some of these other coaches are. How do we change that? I mean, how do we change it so they get these relationships to where they need to be to make them better young men?
I think it's really tough because of social media has turned your individual player into a business. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I think of it this way. You have these tiers of football players. So the quarterbacks, the receivers, the guys that catch the ball, the guys that score the touchdowns. They're your flash guys, right? Like, they're your fast, wow, this guy is explosive. He's making plays. The quarterbacks are going to make the money. Those guys are going to make the money. But who's more important, the quarterback throwing the ball or the guy that's stopping the defensive lineman from hitting him before he throws the ball?
Yeah.
So you might have a quarterback driving in the parking lot in a Bentley, but the tackle who's protecting his backside is driving his high school truck that, you know, he's making a quarter – to, you know, not even close to what the quarterback's making. But if it isn't for him, the quarterback isn't surviving.
Right.
You know, so at the end of the day, you have to have a team dynamic. You have to have togetherness and mm-hmm. understanding and working together and knowing, hey, this guy's an asshole. I'm not going to help him.
Yeah.
Oh, I missed my block.
Yeah. You know? Yeah. Season over.
Whoa, see you later. So I think it's definitely challenging. It definitely is challenging. But now, when I look at IU and the success that IU's having, and I listen to the head coach talk, I love everything that he's saying, because he's saying, I don't recruit five-star athletes. I recruit coachable players. So if you look at the United States as a whole, then you look at all the talent, you can go and find great football players that have a good want-to-learn mentality. And – you know, there's a ton of great parents out there that are teaching their kids the right things to do. And, you know, we want you to have a high character. We want you to be a team player. We want you to do all these things. And I think he's seeking those guys. And that's why his team is doing really well, and they're number two in the country.
Well, that, I think, takes the page out of the Belichick book in the years where he had all these drafts where the players weren't all these superstar players, at least what I saw from the outside looking in. But, I mean, Stephen Neal's one of them, never played football until he got out of college. Like, he's a wrestler. So, I mean, can you speak a little bit to your success as a New England Patriot and how that was good for your development, but also different from when you were at the other organizations you were at as a
I wasn't – I mean, I was a three-star guy. I wasn't recruited highly. I was telling Doc before – I went to Northern State University in Aberdeen, South Dakota. I went on a visit there, like NAIA, below D3.
Yeah.
And the only reason I took a visit there was because I felt pressure to go somewhere because I wasn't offered anything. And I was like, man, I'm like an all-state player in Illinois, but I have zero offers. I'm not – like, why? And that just didn't happen. I was a little undersized for what – in 2002, 2003, defensive ends in the Big Ten were 6'5", 290. You know, they were big, big. There was famous, a 4'3 mentality. It was like you're Nebraska, you're big, big dudes. And Purdue, I went to junior college, and I was the first, like, tweener of the undersized DN, 6'3", 250, 260. That was like the first initial wave of all that, the pass rusher, you know. And there were schools like Illinois and Notre Dame. They were like, yeah, you're just too small, man. Like, you're
260 is too small.
Yeah, for a DN.
That's crazy.
So when I went to Purdue, they had Roosevelt Colvin, Chike O'Keefer, Sean Phillips, who was like my size. Anthony Spencer was a first-round pick. Myself, Ray Edwards. You know, now we've had Ryan Kerrigan and George Karlofkis, who's with Kansas City. We're all similar. We're all similar body types. And that's what Purdue was known for, the den of the defensive ends, the guys that weren't the biggest. But when I got there, they didn't offer me a scholarship at DN. They offered me a scholarship as a tight end. So, you know, Joe Tiller, I said, hey, can you give me a guarantee that I'll get one day on defense and one day on offense? He's like, sure, I'll give you a day on defense. And I just was better at defense, so they kept me there. And I didn't redshirt. So I think that when you look at certain schools like Purdue and guys like myself that were three-star athletes, they weren't the five-star athlete, you know, sometimes that silver spoon treatment in the platter and everything's there for you is an opportunity for a guy like me, because all I need is a little slip up, you know. And at Purdue, for example, they gave it Jeremy Cooley. He was the number one defensive end in the country that they gave a scholarship to, and he was gone within the first 3 weeks of the school year.
Wow.
He failed out, and I was just like, hey, I'm ready.
Yeah here we go,
you know. And there I go, and then off it goes. And you know, there's, going back to the NIL thing, there's something to be said about earning and working for what you're given. You know, if I hand you a brand new pair of shoes that you didn't work for, you might walk through or cut the grass in them and not think twice about it. But if you work for those shoes and they're brand new, you're going to say, let me take these off. I'm going to put my junky ones on because I don't want to get them dirty.
Yeah.
You know, that's just like a career. That's just like anything.
It's like being a father.
When you work for it,
yeah,
you earn it.
Yeah.
You know, if it's just
given to you, then it doesn't mean anything.
It doesn't mean meaningless. Anything. Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Well, why do you think it takes some players years to really break through? I mean, it took you three teams and 4 or 5 years to become a starter, lower draft pick, and you're an integral part of the Super Bowl teams. And you look at other players, look at Daniel Jones this year, look at Sam Darnold, multiple teams.
Yeah.
And it looks like they're finally having success. But you look at other players like Justin Fields, highly drafted, two teams, just can't seem to cut it. Why do you think it takes
I think for myself, I had a confidence issue a little bit. And because I didn't have some of the offers, I was always questioning am I worth being here? Like, am I valuable enough? Am I good enough? And I think back to the offseason before I went to Purdue, I was obsessed. Like, when I talk about obsessed, I was obsessed with making sure I was ready to go, like in shape and strong. So I didn't want to walk into a Big Ten locker room and feel subpar to what those D1 athletes were. So with that, I mean, you know, it's 3 hours a day. It's overtraining. It's putting myself in a position. And then when I do the conditioning test, and the guys that are supposed to be better than me are dying and I'm laughing. And when I'm in the weight room, I'm throwing up weight and they're like looking at me like, damn, this kid's supposed to be my backup, you know? So it's one of them things where I was so consumed with the thought of failure that I couldn't fail, if that makes sense. And then when I got injured, I think that first 3 years, if I never was injured, because when I came into the NFL, I was beating all the starters. You know, we had some pro bowlers at tackle that I was just running around. And I was playing like 30 snaps a game my rookie year until I got hurt. But unfortunately, back then, you had to pay your dues, which I think you always have to pay your dues. But for me, I wasn't a wedge break. I wasn't a wedge guy. I wasn't a special team. I was a defensive end. But because I was a fifth-round pick, they expect you to run down on kickoff. And that was when they had the wedge and all that stuff. And I wasn't hitting the wedge. Like, I wasn't a guy that would do that. I would move or give somebody a shake. And that's kind of what got me. I was running down on kickoff. It was a deep kick right. The ball was right at the pylon. I thought I could go get the guy. And instead of going towards where I was supposed to go, I went to the ball. And when I cut, I got hit at the same time. And it kind of twisted me. And that's how I got that big rotational tear. But from that point on, that was kind of like the window was there. It was open. I could have went through it. And then, boom, I got hurt. And then in the NFL, the second you're hurt, they move on to the next guy. And when there's also money in play. So if a guy gets a big contract, you're less likely to take his job. Or if they bring in a guy from another team and you're a free agent, you're less likely to get the opportunity to take your job because somebody gave him that job, gave him that money, gave him that. So if you take it, they look pretty stupid for wasting that money. And then from 8 months later, I came back from this one. I tore my MCL grade 3 on this one. Somebody rolled up on me. So I had two knees that I was trying. This one was fine. This one was gone. So I'm like taping it up, wiggling all around, putting a brace on it, trying to practice. You know, it sucked. You know, so then I get cut, go to Miami. And that's one thing too. When you get cut from one place and you go to the other place, they don't know that you have, or they know on your records, but they don't know the process. They're like, oh yeah, he had ACL last year. He's got an MCL now. Why aren't you so explosive? You know, it's yeah, like, right. Well, I'm 8-9 months out of like a complete ACL repair. It took me like 2 years to feel really good. And I think back to the first kickoff that I was in after this, having to do the same exact thing. I was crying. I swear to God, I was crying in my helmet. I'm like, I don't want to do this. I don't want to do this right now. It just took me a year to come back from this.
It's scary.
It's the last thing I want to do is go run down on a R3 kickoff the same exact way and go do this for you. You know, same for me. It's for you. It's for these guys that are telling me to do it. Mm-hmm. And because all I wanted was the opportunity to play and start. You know, I had all these goals. When I was a kid, I used to write down goals and put them on a piece of paper. And every year I would write new goals. And it would either be, you know, be stronger, be faster, be the best in this position. And I would always check them off. Like at the end of the year, I'd be like, damn, I did all that. And then I'd write down what else I did or my accolades. So I always had be an NFL starter as one of my goals. And I was always close, but because of the injury, I just couldn't get there. And when I came here to New England, I knew it was an opportunity, just like the window. It was an opportunity to just have a chance to play. And with that, you know, taking advantage of that opportunity, staying healthy. You know, if I wasn't healthy, there's no way you can provide if you're injured. So having those hiccups in my first 3 years, I think helped me understand the business aspect of, okay, it doesn't matter. It's not the coach's fault if I can't play or if I'm not available. And availability is way more reliable than ability. So you're really good, but you're not available. What am I going to do about that? I'm going to have to go with the guy that's available.
Yeah, we have the three A's in medicine. Ability,
yep.
Availability, and affability.
Yep.
And number one is availability.
Availability.
Once you're available, you can get the skills to take care of patients.
Yep.
And you can be great to patients and have great bedside manner.
Yep.
If you're not available on the field, it doesn't matter.
It doesn't matter. So, you know, I would see guys, and I would look at the draft, and I would have guys come in that were in my position, and I would just observe them in the offseason. And I was always good at kind of knowing and sensing if a guy's got it or not. And the second I could see a little weakness, I'd be like, it doesn't matter what round this guy's in. He's not taking my job. I can guarantee it. You know, because when you're dealing with, you know, a pec tear or a tricep tear, and you're just like, fuck it, I'll suck it up. This guy's not taking my job. You know, like there's a mental side to dealing and putting stuff away and fighting through stuff. And some guys, when they have to deal with stuff while perform, they can't do it. Like mentally, they can't do it. Or they have MEs, they have mental errors. They have, you know, they're not supposed to be in the right spot. They're a little injured. They're thinking about it and it messes them up, you know, on the field.
So in order to create a championship type locker room, you need a core group of players
that are a little bit crazy.
Yeah. A little bit crazy. And
you definitely had that.
I'm a little bit crazy. Yeah. But I'm just like Tom.
So do you think,
and Tom is crazy too.
Yeah.
Tom is crazy. I mean, I'm crazy. Julian's crazy. Dole is crazy. Wes is crazy.
We know Gronk's crazy.
Vrabel's crazy. We're all a little bit crazy, you know? So if you're going to play football at a certain level and you want to win championships, and this is something that I learned probably going through those injuries and going to some of these really bad teams, you could make a lot of money, but if you don't have anything to show for it, there's other people that always have more money than you. And there's always people that are going to have money. But, you know, I go to these events and I talk to people that are billionaires or they're big company owners and they have all this success. They don't have a Super Bowl ring. Mm-mm. You know, they got a house in Nantucket and they got all these nice cars and they got this business that's making them millions of dollars. But there's one thing they can never buy that has their name on it, and that's being a Super Bowl champion. Something that goes down on a piece of paper or on a trophy or in history that never goes away. So, you know, some of these guys chase money and they're like, hey, I'm going to Cleveland for the bigger payday.
Not going to win in Cleveland.
Not going to win in Cleveland. You know, so you might have
punch in, punch out every day and not really buy into the team.
It's just not because it starts at the top. So, you know, I know the last 5 years has been a little bit difficult here in New England, but, you know, you also have to have the horses. You got to have to win the Derby. You got to have the horses. Yeah. So you got to have the talent. You know, what are the what's the one thing we've seen this last year with New England? They got a hell of a quarterback. You got to have somebody that can push the ball down the field. You got to have talent. And now they have more talent, so now they're winning. But then they also have the right mentality, and that comes from the coach. You know, and Bill did a great job of pushing guys, you know, understanding how to get the best out of each player dependent on their personality, you know. I'm one of them guys, you might come up to me and say, well, Rob, looks like you're not going to be the guy next week. You know, you're missing a couple tackles here. And you're like, okay.
Yeah.
You know, Tom, you might say, getting, you know, so-called best quarterback, I don't know.
Matt Castle looking pretty good in practice.
Yeah. You know, throwing that interception in cover two, I don't know. Best players don't do that. You know?
So since we're on the conversation of our New England Patriots, what do you think of the team this year?
I think, dude, I'm happy that they're 9-2. Yeah. I think that they're taking advantage of what the season is, the schedule is. Like,
yeah.
You can't control who you play.
Right.
I think we're seeing a little bit of the inconsistencies across the NFL. So, okay, 1 week a team looks good. The next week they look bad. We didn't expect the Ravens, the Bengals, all these teams to not be good, and we didn't expect the Colts and some of these other teams to look good, right? Mm-hmm. So you have some teams that were middle of the road that look good. The Patriots, I think I was expecting like a 10-win, 9-win max. Like I wasn't putting
the rest of us.
I thought they were going to be a lot better because when you spend 300 plus million in free agency, like that's a lot of talent you're bringing in. Plus you double your staff. You know, they brought in a new coaching staff. They double the staff, support staff.
Yeah.
They invested a ton of money into the, I mean, it's probably half a billion just in this year in free agency and coaching. So, you better win.
Yeah, you better start winning.
What do you think about Coach Vrabel that adds to that winning culture?
I think he's got the best of both worlds when it comes to a player's mindset and a coach's understanding of how a player needs to be mentally and physically to succeed. I think you talk about it all the time, or he talks about it all the time. It's trying to build a mentality, create the culture, get the best from the players. He talks about, I mean, early in the season, he was always talking about working on Drake's leadership. Now, what that means is you don't have to be a vocal leader at any point. You have to perform. So performance is the best indicator of leadership. If you can't perform, I can't follow you. But if you're really performing week in and week out, you don't have to say a word. Mm-hmm. You really don't have to say anything. You're a leader. So I think that's really what he was trying to do. And now he's one of the best quarterbacks in the league. And he's very humble. And they ask him about, hey, who's the MVP, blah, blah, blah. They're chanting your name. And then he throws it off to Baker. Like, oh, they're chanting for Baker. You know? So he has the humble approach to it. But I also think that with his performances, they got a leader. You know? And that's really – that's how when the Patriots of old were winning championships – we had a lot of guys that were performing at a high level that didn't have to talk about leadership. You just followed suit. And then the young guys, they see it and they're like, all right, so if I do, what I'm supposed to do, I lift what I'm supposed to lift, I'm on time, I do my job wherever they ask me to do it, and we win, that's how, then we're all winning. Mm-hmm. Like that's how that's contagious, that whole like foundational mentality of how do you build a long-term franchise.
Do you think Belichick's having a tough time motivating some of the
college kids? I think he's having a hard time with college because, number one, they didn't have the horses to begin with. So I was shocked that he went there because they're not known for being a great football team. Mm-hmm. You know, if he went to Alabama or if he went to Texas, I'd be like, oh, okay. Like, that's like Matty P. Matty P's at Ohio State right now. You know, there's probably 9 NFL players on that defense right now. Mm-hmm. 9 future NFL players. I mean, you could just say cover one. And they're going to beat every team.
They're so much better.
They're so much better. Yeah, run cover two. Oh, yeah, Mike Blitz. Like, they're going to beat everybody that they face. But if you have a team like Carolina, they might have one NFL player on their roster. That's offense and defense. Maybe two.
Yeah.
It's harder to get that level of execution. And I saw it in high school football. When I would coach high school football, I was helping Zavarian. And I say, hey, take a 6-inch step and get your inside hand to the breastplate and really extend your arm. And they're like, what? Like, oh, you don't even know what that is. Like, let's get our stances right first. It's baby steps. That gets frustrating. So then you can't have an advanced defense or you can't have advanced stuff that. So it's I think it's a difficult situation for him, but. He's making $10 million a year, so I don't feel bad for him.
True. And he has a house on Nantucket.
And he has a house.
And a boat.
He's actually, I mean, he's going to have $40 to $50 million no matter what. Yeah. So that's crazy.
Super Bowls. Let's. I've asked him, I wanted to ask this question.
Hit him.
This is the one I've always wanted to know. What was the conversation at halftime at the Atlanta game?
So that, you know, honestly, I think when you're in that game, you know everyone's watching. And that was more of an, this is an embarrassing first half of football for us. This isn't us. This isn't our identity. We're not this bad. We're not going to get blown out like this. Let's just make this thing competitive. So there wasn't a big rah-rah speech. There wasn't the, hey, like, you know, guys standing on a chair. It wasn't at all. It was like, hey, we need to play our type of football. Let's go out here one play at a time. You know, I think Bill said there's no 28-point touchdowns. So you can't score 28 points in one play.
Yeah.
You got to just do it play by play, chip away at it. And, you know, football, we all know, is such a emotional roller coaster. And there's also the things can go one way or the other. Like, they start to go one way and the swing is quick. And if you don't make a play and react to it, you can lose that momentum. Mm-hmm. And they lost the momentum. You could feel it. And they also got tired. So that was a game where there was a lot of plays defensively for them.
Yeah.
And if you weren't in shape, you could see when teams started to fatigue in the fourth quarter and guys that didn't. Mm-hmm. You know, there's some plays, you know, we'd be at home against Miami and I'd turn around and they're huddled with their hands in their pockets, like in their thing. And I'm like,
yeah,
you want to go home already? Like, it's over, you know? So. Yeah. I think Atlanta, that you could feel that momentum shift, and then they started to get tight. And when you start to get tight,
yeah,
it's not good. It's not good. And, you know, I think at Seattle, there's always these coordinators that if you're a coordinator in the Super Bowl, the majority of MVPs are quarterbacks.
Yeah.
Right? if they just stuck to a simple game plan of taking points that were available to them, they'd probably win that game, just like Seattle. But these coordinators and guys of these decision makers, hey, it's 3rd and 7. Let's throw the ball here.
Yeah.
If we throw the ball, we get a first down. Matt Ryan's the MVP. You know, everyone's hooting and hollering. Great play call. You throw it, you get sacked.
Yeah,
you fumble.
Yeah.
The game completely changes.
Yeah.
You know, hey, we're on the 1 yard line. We got the best running back of all time.
Let's pass the
ball. Let's throw the ball.
I still can't figure that out.
Who's MVP if Russell Wilson throws a touchdown pass right there?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Russell Wilson.
Yeah.
So good for me.
Twice.
Good for me. Twice. You know?
Favorite Super Bowl victory?
Yeah, it's got to be Seattle.
Seattle.
I mean, that was my 9th year. So at that point, I was getting old, you know, and I knew, like, okay, clock's ticking. Mm-hmm. We had a 10-year hiatus of winning the Super Bowl. So I think when you play for the Patriots, they had that 01, 03, 04 run, but then they lose in 07, they lose in 11.
Glue on the helmet.
Yeah. It's people assume because you're number 50 that you have a Super Bowl ring, but I'm like, no, that's Vrabel that got the Super Bowl ring. I haven't won anything. I've got an AFC championship game or win that doesn't mean anything.
Yeah.
So being able to win that game the way that we won it, and, you know, there was a couple of big plays that I made in that game that if we didn't make them, we don't win. You know, there was like a 3rd and 1 play that I hold them to a field goal. There's a 3rd and 7 sack that puts them in. They had to punt the ball back to us. I look at that game. I always had a win or a loss rating system for my games. Like, that was a winning. You either have a winning or a losing performance. That's it. And I think my last game I ever played in, I didn't have a winning performance. You know, I probably at that point I was like, fuck, I'm hanging on by the skin of my teeth. I'm trying to chase guys that are running 4.40s out of the backfield.
Yeah.
I'm like hanging on. So I was just happy that we were able to get that win and happy as a team. Like, having that biggest comeback of all time, it was, and that being my last game, I knew, I was like,
yeah, it's pretty good.
Great.
Yeah.
But Seattle was a hell of a win. It was a great team. And we had a really good team that year. Great guys, great chemistry. Guys stepped up in big moments that you didn't expect to step up. And that was probably like getting the 1,000-pound weight vest off of me. Because if you didn't win that one, you're like,
yeah, got to come back for more.
No.
Got to keep going.
Yeah.
You know.
Who's the best defensive player you've ever played with?
I mean, I play with a lot of great ones. I think probably Revis was one of the most, like, athletic. Revis, Keeb Talib was pretty special when it comes to just playing defense. Inside backers, Mayo was the smartest guy I've ever played with, like, as far as quickness. Like, he would just bang, bang, bang.
Yeah.
Devin was really smart, really good player. Hightower, really good player, smart player. Vince.
Of course.
A lot of great players that played with. Chandler, talented, super talented player. So, long list of great players.
Yeah,
no question. That's it, Rob. All right,
Dr. Rob, Gil. Thanks, man.
Thank you.
Appreciate it.
Appreciate it. Awesome. Nice, man. Thanks, Doc. Great. I'll see you for the adductor release soon.
Exactly.
Yeah. Oh, are you going
to
do that?
I need to do it.
We'll get a quick picture.
Thanks for listening to Behind the Sports Medicine Podcast. Follow us on social media and check out our website.
The information shared on this podcast is for educational and informational purposes only and is not intended as medical advice. Please consult a licensed healthcare provider for guidance related to your specific situation. We'll see you next week.